Welcome to Race and Democracy, a podcast on the intersection between race, democracy, public policy, social justice, and citizenship. Today, we are joined by Dr. Derek Hamilton, who is University Professor, Henry Cohen Professor of Economics and Urban Policy, and founding director of the Institute on Race, Power, and Political Economy at the New School. Considered one of the nation's foremost public intellectuals, Professor Hamilton redefines how an economy should work, identifies powerful opportunities for investment in human capacity, and propels collaboration alongside field leaders to advance the realization of economic inclusion, social equity, and civic engagement for all people in the U.S. and across the globe. One of the pioneers of identity group stratification, Dr. Hamilton has been profiled in the New York Times, Mother Jones, Bloomberg's Business Weekly, and the Wall Street Journal. He has developed and collaborated on transformative policy proposals that have shifted billions of dollars into the hands of people, inspiring legislative proposals at the federal, state, and local levels, including baby bonds, guaranteed income, and a federal job guarantee. Professor Hamilton was named a Freedom Scholar by the Marguerite Casey Foundation. He advises national and global leaders on economic policy, including the Joint Economic Committee and the Senate Banking Committee. Born and raised in the Bedford-Stuyvesant section of Brooklyn, New York, Bed-Stuy, do or die, he is a graduate of Oberlin College and received a PhD in economics from the University of North Carolina. Okay, Dr. Derek Hamilton, welcome to Race and Democracy.
Such an honor to be here. Grateful for that warm introduction that probably went a little long, but I appreciate it. Thank you.
Derek, you've been one of my favorite public intellectuals to watch rise. And it's interesting because I've read those profiles, including the one in the New York Times and Mother Jones and all those things. So I love seeing you shine nationally and globally. You know, my first question is, there are so few African-American economists in the United States. What made you interested in this field? Because I want people to know, because you're really a role model, so to know it's possible. But what made you interested in economics as a vehicle for both scholarship, academic scholarship, but also service-oriented public leadership?
Some of it is plain dumb luck. When I started out in college, I majored in economics because I thought it was a gateway towards law school or business school. And frankly, I did not want to be poor. I grew up, as you mentioned, in Bed-Stuy. I had the benefit and privilege of parents that reached over their head and sent me to certain elite school environments. And I like to make the point, I lost my parents, so this is not a story of a Cinderella story that I'm trying to give. I would actually call it a sad story that I lost them trying to put forth effort to put me in that environment. But nonetheless, there's nothing romantic about poverty. And I majored in economics thinking it was going to be a feeder to law school or business school. The reality is that when I was in college, I also got exposed to many affirmative action programs like the Ronald E. McNair Fellowship Program. I see you clapping. You might have had experience with that.
I've been a mentor to McNair scholars. So, I mean, yes, yes.
That's what's up. I guess it's also suggesting you're much older than me. So I like that. Me trying to be funny. But then also there were other ones. There was a Ford Mellon Fellowship Program. So I got exposed to doing some deep research with faculty members. And I realized at that point, I'm passionate about scholarship. So I got lucky. That was luck. And then I also realized from those experiences that I can make a good living. I wasn't going to be poor, that I could have a really good living and pursue passions that inspired me. You also began this talking about why there's so few economists. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, I believe that the discipline has reached an orthodoxy that is not welcoming in terms of its scholarship. And I say orthodoxy and frankly dogma because one of the limitations of economics is its inability to explain persistent group disparity beyond human capital, beyond some attribute within the group as explanation as to why they're not as successful as another group. So that's you know, almost prima facie kind of hostile to Black people, because if we see these gross disparities that exist and the discipline has inadequacies in trying to explain that persistent inequality beyond some deficit narrative that would be applied to Black people.
So they say it's behavioral.
They would suggest it's behavioral.
Yeah, instead of structural and the histories and the institutions, they'll say it's behavioral.
And all of the work you do, for instance, can point to certain institutional interventions. And you know, we're dancing around it. We could say the word discrimination.
Discrimination,
right?
Absolutely.
That there's a long and consistent and present history of discrimination directed towards Black people. And you know, the good thing is that there are people in the discipline who perhaps aren't mainstream, that are coming up with theories and approaches that are better able to explain this persistent group disparity.
That's a great segue into what I want to lead the conversation into, because your work has done so much, and I was reading in your bio too, but to really address what we call the wealth gap, and really the racial wealth gap in the United States of America, which has a long history going back to antebellum slavery to the present. I want to ask you about 2020 and the inflection point, the racial inflection point in the aftermath of George Floyd's really public execution and murder on May 25th, 2020. There was a huge Black Lives Matter movement. There was a huge push by activists to challenge corporate America, but also federal, state, local governments to really enact what I would call redistributive justice policies. Some people would call it reparations. I think reparations are inclusive of that, but I think redistributive justice is even bigger than reparations, because I define redistributive justice as not only repair for racial slavery or Jim Crow or what happened in Selma or a discrete thing that happened. I think redistributive justice is saying we are going to actively utilize resources that are publicly funded resources to help the least of these, right? And that could include everything from a universal basic income. It can include everything from free transportation, free education, not just K through 12 and community colleges, but all the way through, and also free housing, right? So there was a real conversation about these things. People gave money to Black Lives Matter, but corporations pledged at times billions of dollars towards what I would call redistributive justice. My first question is really, what happened to that sentiment? Especially, I'm speaking to you in the midst, it's Black History Month, of a huge national backlash, really global even, against the very idea of what I call Black citizenship and dignity.
You know, first off, I'd say that we can simply call the framing justice. We don't even have to have adjectives like redistributive or reparations. They all fit within the category of justice, and they all have their place, and they all come together. We don't need a single silver bullet. Frankly, we need it all. So there is the redistributive aspect. There's a reparations aspect. And they might have overlap, but they ain't the same. There's special elements to them. And then I'll interject another word, which is investments. Why don't we think about the direction of public resource directly towards people to enhance their capabilities well beyond consumption, but literally to facilitate them to do big, bold, productive things? So that is one another concept in the way which I see it. The other real quick aside I'll say is, I love guaranteed income, but can't stand UBI, universal basic income. And I'm being somewhat tongue-in-cheek. The universal aspect of basic income would be a problem. If you literally gave everybody the same amount throughout the whole economy with UBI,
It doesn't work. Yeah,
it's inflationary,
right.
It's almost inflationary. By definition. Yep. And it also would promote inequality because those with resources, they're better positioned to invest because their consumption needs are already taken care of. If you're low income, then it would make sense if you get additional income. Well, you're subsistence. You got to buy food. You got to eat. So we would need some gradational, some graduated, some progressive implementation of guaranteed income.
So not everyone gets it.
Not everyone gets it, and if everyone did get it, it would be progressively seeded. But no, everybody wouldn't get it. That wouldn't make sense. All right, so long-winded answers. Thank you for bringing me home. We're naive if we don't recognize that everything we do has political aspects to it. Everything we do has political, economic, and identity group stratification aspects to it. And what do I mean by the latter? We think about who is deserving and undeserving. Who we deem worthy of receipt of some public resource is related to politics and economics. So all three of those elements take place. Long-winded answer to get to the point that it was a political moment. It was a political time period. Thank goodness for the activists, part of Black Lives Matter, who talked about violence a little bit different than some of the more recent previous struggles that, you know, we've been experiencing violence throughout, but they made it more structural. And in the more structural arguments around violence, they also linked it to economics as well, politics and economics. And it was through that nuance, we had a moment, we had a sliver where there was enough agitation and pressure that presented to corporations, to government, to various entities, almost all entities in our society, that there was something that needed to be done about the persistent, oppressive economic structures that were linked to the violent structures and vice versa to be addressed.
And, you know, I'll say the next thing I want to ask before I even get to the contemporary is really, how do you think the Biden administration did? Because in certain ways, as a historian and as a scholar of social movements, and as somebody who's also participated in activism, I look at the Biden election, the Biden-Harris election, from my perspective, as clearly a byproduct of a social justice movement. The way in which Biden-Harris got 81 million votes to 74 million, it's not just the pandemic, it's Black Lives Matter becoming the largest social justice movement in the history of the American Republic, upwards of 25 million people in the streets in the spring and summer of 2020, according to the New York Times and other data points. I think Biden-Harris is the result. Some people were very disappointed about what Biden-Harris were able to do for Black people, but also for people who are workers, which obviously includes Black people, but also is bigger than Black or even people of color, because there's white workers, even though people try to make the working class just white. I don't want to exclude white people from the working class, too, because they're a part of it. But some people are very, very discouraged, especially the fact that Biden's $3.5 trillion 10-year Build Back Better plan did not get passed in the way that the administration had envisioned because of two senators, former senators, Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona. How would you judge the Biden administration over the last 4 years and their policies in terms of that 2020 moment and really the politics of investment, the justice politics, right? For example, the child tax credit is usually applauded, but that ran out after the first year or so of the administration because the Congress refused to extend it.
So like me, I guess we're academics. We ask some loaded questions with a part A, B, C, D, E, F, G. I'm kidding with you trying to add some levity to our very serious conversation. I think you're absolutely right in the way you characterize the moment that led to the Biden administration. It was a social movement that made him do a lot of things. That said, for the good things and the bad things, the way we judge administrations is, regardless of the conditions, they often are the ones that bear the credit or the blame. But that point that you made, I certainly want to double down. And it's also good for providing lessons. Rather than be vulnerable to administrations, real power is when we make administrations act on the ways that we desire from a social movement standpoint. And I would say that a lot of that occurred in this administration. There were some unprecedented things that the Biden administration did that 10 years ago, 20 years ago, I would not have predicted this. One, first, executive orders, particularly if you contrast with the executive orders we're seeing right now, were to order his federal agencies to take account of race and come up with plans and provisions to promote racial equity. Now, some may critique it and say, well, where's the real teeth? A rhetoric alone is important. It's not enough, but that should be applauded. Mm-hmm. It was unprecedented. I'd never seen a federal administration. I don't believe there is one throughout. Well, maybe LBJ. Mm-hmm. We're at the LBJ school, but there's scarce federal administrations that would literally call for race to be explicitly taken into account in work plans and for organizations to be accountable in promoting race equity. So that's a start.
Yes.
And then if we look at how we governed during the pandemic, this really got lost. It's almost a miracle that we're not still in a deep recession right now, mm-hmm. considering what we did and where we were. I think people have some memory, but some amnesia as to we had extremely high levels of unemployment, and the federal government sent checks directly to the American people.
Mm-hmm.
However clumsily the PPP program was administered, and we know a lot of black businesses, because of the relationships with banking, because of all the structural embedded difficulties by race that are already in the system, suffered a great deal.
Absolutely.
Even with PPP. But the reality is that we pretty much guaranteed employment for those that were already employed by offering those forgivable payroll loans. I can keep going, but that we did forbearance on student loans. We did, what else did we do? People were not allowed to be evicted. People were not allowed to, right, at least that was the federal policy. I'm sure evictions took place.
Loan forgiveness, the effort at complete loan forgiveness during the Biden administration.
Right, so that was another aspect that came out of the Biden administration.
And also the reparations for black farmers.
Reparations for black farmers. But the big point I'm also trying to get across is the way in which we governed and managed the pandemic. I know inflation became the story,
mm-hmm.
and I don't want to be insensitive to some of the pain that individuals experienced and are still experiencing. But the reality is that we managed that recession much better than we have previous recessions. It was the shortest recession on record. And we implemented essentially an economic rights platform. We, if you were sick and went to a doctor in that period, now who could get to the doctor given the pandemic, you were not saddled with a bill.
Mm-hmm.
So that got lost. And, I give the administration credit for that. Although clearly the narrative space of describing it, they didn't do so well.
No.
Because they lost the news cycles. They didn't. And it's important to be part of the news cycle. And I'd say that part of the knee jerk of not trying to completely overthrow the previous neoliberal experience that we had was part of the narrative problem. So trying to describe things as a new supply-side economics, for instance, that's not a good narrative. Get rid of supply-side economics altogether.
And when you think about the narrative problems that the administration had, was that because of Biden and age? Was it because Kamala Harris was really, until last year, sort of set aside and given tasks that were impossible to complete, like borders are and voting rights, designee, things that couldn't get passed in the Senate. So she was, the media narrative against her was very negative and very harsh, right? And in certain ways during her presidential campaign, she was able to break out of that. But in other ways, she was always held hostage to that. So when it comes to the narrative, was it the White House or was it big tech?
The specific part of the narrative that I think I want to emphasize is the inability to completely divorce themselves from the previous 50 years of neoliberal framing of economics.
And when you say neoliberal framing, Derek, tell us, how do you explain that to our viewers? What do you mean by neoliberal?
Essentially believing that the market is the god, that transactions, small governments, that the best way to determine winners and losers, the best way to distribute resources is grounded in this concept of a free market. Essentially, neoliberal framework is that deregulation, government being small, that the market is the best arbiter of our worth. The market is efficient. It ignores a great deal, and it is problematic. And the administration started to engage in a new form of industrial policy where they were directing resources to the American people and directing resources to ensure that we had a sustainable environment.
Yeah.
So that was a break from the past.
But they had no way to, they had no new branding of what they were doing.
They had no new branding of it and didn't lean into it.
No.
And as a result, they were a little reticent to come out and fully come up with a new narrative.
And then inflation. Because I think what's interesting about inflation, I remember listening to...
And that's the other example, really quick, just to say that it is their inability to divorce themselves from the previous genre of neoliberal framing that they allowed inflation to capture the imagination. They couldn't, in forceful terms, explain price gouging, for example.
Exactly.
So that, you know, that if you're willing to rid yourself of some of that baggage from the past, I suspect they would have been able to come up with better ways to dispute and refute the blame that was they were saddled with around inflation, and also to put inflation in its proper context.
So wrapping up this part, because I want to get to Trump and the contemporary. What do you think are the negatives of the Biden policy? We've talked about some of the positives. What was some low-hanging fruit in the 4 years of the Biden administration? And here I mean specifically vis-a-vis Black people that could have gotten done that weren't that was not.
You know, the other part that's huge, and as it relates to Black people and all their policies, their reticence in using their power. Their reticence in being bolder and stronger in their statements. And again, I think that it is at least in part because they weren't quite ready to overthrow that previous 50 years of neoliberalism. As we began the conversation, it was social movements that got them to the place they were, and they should get credit for that. And as you can hear the way I described the pandemic, it was miraculous how we governed during that pandemic and what we did despite all those losses. But we're, they just quite haven't gotten ready to, with greater force, use the power they have for the American people and lean into the narratives without hesitation.
Let's switch to Trump. So Donald J. Trump has been elected to a second term as president of the United States, took over January 20th, and has signed a raft of executive orders that are on their faces anti-Black and really discriminatory and racist. But he's really focused on the federal government and federal workers. They're trying to slash the federal workers by 25%. They've basically virtually shut down USAID, which is really the arm of the United States that provides our soft power over the world, that gives AIDS and HIV drugs, that gives clean food and water and so many different parts.
USAID. Soft positive power,
soft
I'd say.
Positive power.
We impose lots of other power in stealth ways that's a lot more repressive, mainly in the form of lending. The ways in which we lend, that's perhaps one of our monetary power, the ways in which we govern through lending with stringent, unreasonable terms and dictation as to how countries have to operate. That's our big, I guess soft is the word, stealth power for not just purposes, if you ask me, and you did ask me. But going back to what we do with USAID, to a large extent, we're able to provide investments and intervene in positive ways with, you know, not our hugest budget, but yet he's threatened to to not threatened. He's literally frozen their resources, mm-hmm. and also is threatening to eliminate that branch of U.S. governance.
So when you look at Trump, how do you think of Trump? Do you look at the Trump administration as neoliberals, or are they oligarchs and it's a kleptocracy?
You know, we don't like this word, but you got to add the word fascism at least to some extent. I think it's beyond the oligarchs because there's an explicit use of relative status. There's an explicit use of race, so it can't be reduced to class. His power is grounded at least in part in offering for political allegiance relative status to his base.
And when you say relative status, you mean enhanced status for whites, especially whites interested in white ethnic nationalism, like the new Secretary of Defense?
Yes. The reason why I'm using the word relative status, because it's juxtaposed against some other group. So that is where that power lies, mm-hmm. that in a relative sense, however bad your lot in life may be to his base, you are better than this other entity that I'm coming after.
And that's why he's trying to fire so many black folks, because black folks are overrepresented in the federal workforce.
Part of the symbol. They become part of the distraction. And not just symbol and distraction. That is the bargain. You know, the term we'd use historically, the Faustian bargain. But that is the bargain. Go along with this. Look over here. Allow me to engage with Elon Musk in the ways in which he has access to Treasury, our transaction data, which is extremely valuable to a person like Elon Musk. Allow all that to occur. Allow me to threaten the Department of Education. And in exchange, I will solidify your position through relative status. That seems to be the grand old bargain. And we've seen this in the past.
Absolutely. We saw this during Reconstruction. And the period of redemption, we saw it during the Jim Crow period. What's astonishing now is that we actually haven't seen it when the federal government became the modern American state, which for me is post-New Deal, Second World War. Because the New Deal is extraordinary, but we don't get out of the Great Depression until the Second World War.
Have we not seen it? I mean, Barry Goldwater, the Southern strategy.
I think we saw people. What's interesting, I'll say this, Derek, as a historian, I think what we saw, and you know, I just finished a book on 1963, Freedom Season. I think that what we saw is that what the 60s usher in, from my perspective as a historian, is they usher in a 50-year racial justice consensus. And I'll explain what I mean. They usher in a rough consensus where it's imperfect. The rise of mass incarceration parallels it. But America has always been two things or more at once. So there's a racial justice consensus paralleling that is a white supremacist, far right, authoritarian, John Bircher conspiracy theorist group, including connected to William F. Buckley, Barry Goldwater, the National Review, and even certain liberals like Norman Podhoretz become right wing before the 1967 Arab-Israeli War.
Yeah.
When you read My Negro Problem and Ours by Norman Podhoretz in commentary, where he's railing against black folks, and it's really a response to Jimmy Baldwin, his friend at the Times, Fire Next Time, that is somebody who's going all in on this authoritarian march. But what's paralleling it in 63 and actually what's winning the day is the racial justice consensus. That's why it's actually extraordinary what happens. We get no Barack Obama or Michelle Obama or anything without the movement that happens and really crystallizes in 63. Before BLM in 2020, 63 is that magic moment.
You know, I am honored and privileged to be able to have this conversation with you because of the depth of your knowledge. And I authentically mean that. And this is I wish I had more of this in my life, just from a selfish standpoint. This is where neoliberalism comes in.
Yep.
So neoliberalism becomes the mechanism where you can have this explicit racial justice framing from the period that you demark. But yet still apply these tactics of relative status.
Yes.
And, you know, our good friend Eduardo Bonilla Silva in his book, Racism Without
Absolutely,
Racism.
Yes.
So the point that I'm trying to make with I should add a little more clarity, is that the assault on race and the use of relative status didn't stop. It continued. It evolved.
It did.
So neoliberalism became the mechanism by which you can have this transformation towards a country that is in this moment of racial justice. And you know, obviously that's there were periods in which we had police brutality, et cetera.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, and I know
it's
you're not denying
that. At the same time, no.
But fundamentally, by the dawning of neoliberalism in the mid-1970s, the disparities across race became stagnant. Yeah. And that became the tool and the mechanism, this fictive market of being some fair arbiter. Notions of meritocracy became code words in which we could, even today, I know we're probably going to talk about this notion, DEI, et cetera, that somehow promoting black is necessarily inefficient. There's this fictiveness, this discourse from neoliberalism that's permissive of that. It became more stealth.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree with that. What I think about the racial justice consensus, to talk about the positives, because you've talked about the underside, which I completely agree with you, is that between 63 and the Shelby v. Holder decision 2013, which I mark as the end of that consensus, and because when you think about 2013 and that decision, what that decision does, 5-4, is end the Voting Rights Act as we knew it. And that Voting Rights Act, the most robust version of which gets expanded by Barbara Jordan and others in 1975, which includes Texas and the Southwest in it. In terms of when you think about the Voting Rights Act, it's a five-year act in 1965. It's renewed in 1970 for 5 years, but then it's renewed in 1975 for 7 years. And in that renewal, that's how we have bilingual voto aquí. That's how we have so many different aspects. And that's how Texas becomes part of the Voting Rights Act. Then it's renewed for 25 years till 2007. And then it's renewed for another 25 years. So what's interesting here is that for a moment, stay with me. John Roberts had no business, if he's a strict constructionist, of judging that, because Congress had renewed it for 25 years. So Shelby v. Holder should have never happened. That should have been a pass. That should have been a pass. But what he does is that 2020, the census data showed us for the first and only time in American history, 66% of black people voted in a presidential election versus 64% of white people. That's the only time that's happened in American history, once. And right after that, you get Shelby v. Holder. And that's how Barack Obama won two times. In 2008, Obama got 43% of the white vote. By 2012, 39% of the white vote, yet he still won a sizable electoral majority.
So my litmus isn't Barack Obama getting elected.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's an important litmus as it relates to perhaps civil, political inclusion that a black person can be president. But for there to be justice, you need elements of civil, political, social, cultural, and then here's the other big one, economics, economic justice. We also know that during the Obama presidency, we had some of the most growing inequality, even in the race domain, during that period. So having a black president in and of itself, particularly if they're governing in such a way that is a continuity of the neoliberal policies that led to divestment away from people and strategic direction of public resource towards firm and a liberalization without addressing power and endowment in the first place, you end up with conditions of growing inequality. So just to put a summation on it, and this is, I think, a valuable for us if we think going forward, any concept of justice is not only incomplete if it doesn't have economics in it, I actually think it becomes a co-optation. I think we seemingly believe that we're on a trajectory of inclusion and justice when we have the capability of vote. That's a necessary condition. But if there's growing despair and inequality as well, that's not a trend towards justice. Again, just to put a button on it, civil, political, social, and economic rights are intertwined and inseparable. And if one were to exclude or separate any of those entities from the other, you end up with potentially co-opting notions of justice. And that's how I would characterize the trajectory for black people in America.
At this current moment, there are these national assaults on DEI, diversity, equity, inclusion, banned in state of Texas through SB 17, no more DEI trainings at the University of Texas at Austin, but also system-wide. The anti-woke acts happening in Florida, Texas, but even some blue states as well. University of Michigan is now talking about, you know, DEI in negative ways. One, in certain ways, we've talked around it, and so I want us to specifically talk, why do you think this anti-DEI wave is happening? How do you think it hurts us economically in terms of being a more effective nation, right? And is it just simply like what you were saying earlier, Professor Hamilton, you were saying, is it simply telling your base to look the other way? You can show them that you're attacking DEI while you're doing all kinds of things economically to enrich Elon Musk and Jared Kushner and to enrich yourselves and your family. And as you said so adroitly earlier, is it also simply just paying the dues that are owed the base? Because that's what you promised them. You promised them an evisceration of that racial justice compact that I like to talk about, right? Even with all its flaws really produced us, even though neoliberal, I agree, everything. But the only way we get access to higher education, if we weren't living in that 63 to 2013 period, I wouldn't be teaching at University of Texas at Austin if I was born in 1883. Not at all, if I was born in 1903. I don't care how smart or talented I was. They simply wouldn't let me teach here. Right. And so things were different over that 50-year period. There were some black people, not those who were imprisoned, not those who were marginalized, but there are some who got access to become Negro firsts and black firsts and all this excellence and get access to predominantly white institutions, including some who made vast amounts of wealth, not just celebrities and entertainers. I'm thinking about people like Robert F. Smith and others. In private equity and hedge fund, Bill Perkins, others. So, yeah.
Lot there. So, first and foremost, I hope I'm not conveying a notion that there hasn't been dramatic progress for black people, particularly since 1940. Right. There was dramatic civil, political, social, and economic progress up to about the mid-1970s, and that's when the economic progress stagnated. So that's thing one. Let me make that point very clear, that a lot of that was the result of efforts of all of the various social movements that allowed for that. That's thing one. The question as to the assault on DEI today, well, Trump is extremely effective. That should be obvious to us by now. If it wasn't the first time, at this point, we'd have to have our head in the sand if we don't see that's obvious. His effectiveness, as well as the embedded racism that's in the social and economic fabric of the United States. But I want to add this other point. It is a bipartisan economy, both Democrats and Republicans, that have facilitated the economic conditions that have made Trump's message so effective to a segment of the population. It is through despair, it is through vulnerability that a message of relative status can become potent, that you can tell somebody that your absolute status, the system's been rigged, you can acknowledge all that, and then you can leave them vulnerable to the base lure of, here's what I'm going to offer you, relative status. And I keep saying that word, relative status. Well, relative status in part can be distracting. You can offer somebody something over here, look over here while I do this other stuff. But we'd be naive to not recognize that there are material and psychological benefits associated with being part of a dominant group. Now, there are other values in the human psyche also, like solidarity and how we emphasize, if we emphasize self-interested behavior without notions of solidarity, tranquility, longevity. Well, if we emphasize this set of human values over another, it will lead to debasing us. It'll lead to the type of society and pain that we're experiencing right now. So Trump has been effective in exploiting a condition that was facilitated in a bipartisan way. I want to make that clear. So all those things can be true. Then we want to be interested in solutions. And there are solutions. And there are periods in which we've had some progress. We haven't done it in a sustained way. But I believe the solution lies in the vision of King, for instance. And he's not alone. An industrial policy that's investing in an inclusive way towards the American people, ensuring that they're is health care, that there's not the vulnerability of not having a job with decent wages, that you at least have some capital foundation to build wealth. If we are able to do that in an inclusive way, and this ain't handouts, these are investments. Mm-hmm. I want to keep emphasizing that when you provide people with the proper resources, guess what they do? They thrive. They create innovation and conditions for growth, not only for themselves, but for others. And then here's another aspect of an economy with a vision like that, tranquility. It promotes stability, peace, and tranquility. What it doesn't promote is the capability of Robert Barons to be able to accumulate ad infinitum. The way in which they're able to do that in a democracy is look over here. Mm-hmm. Look at these foreigners coming to impact your way of life. Those things can become distractionary. But again, I want to emphasize they do offer, particularly in vulnerable conditions, some relative status. So our task is to offer a different set of value and invest in that different set of values and have a vision that, for instance, Dr. King, in my mind, had come to towards the twilight of his life.
And you're speaking about Dr. King and the Poor People's Campaign and the beloved community and what he was trying to do.
Exactly. In Memphis. I'm sitting in your office with all the emblems and everything. And it makes clear, it reminds me of that great vision that whatever we're talking about today ain't so original. There was literally the freedom budget that black civil rights leaders put forth.
Rustin,
which was arguing for this. And this again leads to the bigger point. Notions of political, civil rights, if they're devoid of economic rights, you have a problem. All three are necessary conditions.
All right. I think we're going to end it right there. I think that's a great way to end it. I've been talking with Dr. Derek Hamilton, who's University Professor, Henry Cohen Professor of Economics and Urban Policy and Founding Director of the Institute on Race, Power, and Political Economy at the New School, one of America's pioneering economists and public intellectuals. And we've had a great conversation about really the wealth gap, trying to build a justice society and ethos both at the local, regional, national level, and what are some of the obstacles and challenges, but really some of the opportunities that we face as well. Thank you for joining us here on Race and Democracy, Professor Hamilton.
Oh, I thank you. You're awesome. This was awesome. I love this experience. And anytime I get to engage with you, I'd be a fool to say no.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to this episode. And you can check out related content on Twitter at Peniel Joseph. That's PENIELJOSEPH. And our website, csrd.lbj.utexas.edu. And the Center for Study of Race and Democracy is on Facebook as well. This podcast was recorded at the Liberal Arts Development Studio at the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin. Thank you.